This is Ron Orrell, and I'm the host of the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking to Boston College Department of Finance Professor Vyacheslav Foss on a paper he co-authored, The Distribution of Voting Rights to Shareholders. The paper looks at record dates, which is when shareholders have to own shares by to be able to vote them at annual meetings and at special meetings. And this topic may sound wonky, but it can be pretty controversial and have wide-ranging implications for director contests, contested shareholder proposals, contested mergers, you know, all the kinds of things that we kind of focus a lot of attention on here at The Deal and with the Activist Investor Today podcast. So thank you so much for taking the time, Professor Foss.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to discuss my research.
Okay, super. So you took a look at two fascinating director battles that we've covered extensively at The Deal, Carl Icahn's fight at AmTrust in 2018 and Nelson Peltz's contest at DuPont in 2015, one of the most heated ever. And your study examined over 100, tell me if I got this right, over 100,000 distributions of proxy documents to shareholders and found that in about 91% of the times, companies revealed their record date after it already happened. Let me repeat that. In about 91% of the times, companies reveal publicly their record date after it has happened. Let's start with that, Professor Foss. All right, record dates are typically 25 to 60 days prior to meetings. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your study, why you decided to look at this. You know, I immediately started reading it and thought that it struck a chord with me because I was always frustrated that I couldn't figure out what the record dates were for some proxy contests that I've covered in the past. So, you know, why did you look at this and tell a little bit about what you found?
Ron, so the main motivation for this study was to basically understand what happens with this distribution to shareholders. As we know, when shareholders buy shares, they become eligible to receive dividends. And the second right that they get with their shareholdership is the right to vote. On the record date, that vote, the right to vote basically disappears. If you want to influence the voting outcome, you need to buy shares before the ex date. And basically, the first goal of this paper is to understand whether the ex date, the day when the voting right is given to shareholders, whether it's a material event. And this is where we begin from, I think, the best case that shows that this is a very important event is basically DuPont example. Mm-hmm. We see that in that example, when shares go ex-vote and basically shareholders become who buy shares after the day becoming eligible to vote, we see dramatic, almost 100% increase in trading activity for that security. On top of that, we see the prices of DuPont shares drop significantly, indicating that whoever was holding securities before its date was really valuing that right to vote. And then we take, as you described, a large sample of distributions supporting rights to shareholders, over 100,000 distributions. And we show that when the voting event, when shareholder meeting is non-regular in the sense that there is something controversial going on there, such as a proxy contest or shareholder proposal, we see significant changes in trading activity and valuation of these securities on the day. So our big picture conclusion, number one in this paper, is that that day when shareholders receive the right to vote is a material event. And people, market participants care about that event.
Since you mentioned the Nelson Peltz try-in proxy contest at DuPont in 2015, for our listeners that may remember, he kind of narrowly lost, but then the CEO of DuPont, Alan Kuhlman, ultimately resigned as he threatened another contest the following year. And he didn't get, I think, some key index fund support. But so, okay, so basically what I found in your study was the first, and tell me if I got this right, the first public announcement of the record date at the DuPont proxy contest was March 23rd for a record date that had already passed on March 17th. And so you found that there was a lot of trading around the last day you could vote, which was, it's like 2+ days ahead of the, prior to the record date. So you make sure that your trade is closed prior to the record date, which suggests what? That behind the scenes, you know, proxy solicitors on both sides were probably communicating with investors. And you know, a lot of people privately knew, a lot of institutional investors probably were informed from the proxy solicitors that somebody knew the record date ahead of the record date, but it wasn't disclosed in like a SEC filing. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Basically, this is the second step that we take in our paper, and we ask, when do market participants receive that information? And again, in that situation, the DuPont case is a brilliant example of what unfortunately typically happens. As you described, the proxy date in the proxy filing, the disclosed record date publicly first time was on March 23rd, even though the record date was on March 17th. So basically, there was a large group of investors that somehow figured out when the record date, whereas many investors who just read information from publicly available sources remained unaware of that information. And given that event is material, we basically identify a symmetry in the way people become informed about the record date. Now, in the case of that proxy contest, there is another kind of big player in that game. DuPont at that point was New York Stock Exchange listed security, and New York Stock Exchange requires all companies to notify the exchange about the record date.
Notify privately to the exchange.
Privately, yes. Right, and yeah. That happened indeed on March 6th, as exchange requires 10 days before the record date. However, basically what it created, all subscribers that pay New York Stock Exchange to receive that information became informed of the record date on March 6th, but not, again, not retail investors, not shareholders who are maybe thinking about buying securities and influencing the voting outcomes. All these investors basically left uninformed.
And so you can basically pay a fee to the NYC, some corporate actions report service they provide to get the and be informed of the record date. And I suspect some large institutions and maybe proxy solicitors, they pay for that information so that they know, an institution knows that they could have to call back shares that they've lent so they can vote them prior to the record date, or a proxy solicitor can inform an investor that it supports, you know, the incumbent slate, or if you're advising the activist, you know, supports a dissident slate, that, oh, this is the date, you have to call your shares back, or please vote your shares, don't sell the shares now, keep them, you know, so that you have them prior to the record date, and all these different things going on behind the scenes with certain people knowing what the record date is.
Absolutely. This is, I believe, correct description of what is going on. Yeah, what is important to emphasize is the way the regulation works right now is that the companies, management of companies decides whether to inform the public about the record date or not. They do need to inform large brokerage companies and exchange in case of New York Stock Exchange. But again, this information is not necessarily flowing to retail investors. Many market participants left uninformed because of that. And basically, one of the points that we're making is that the way that information is communicated when we think about the voting rights is very different. It's dramatically different from what happens, for example, in case of dividends. When dividends are distributed, it's by law the requirement that the dividend record date is announced prior to the record date in the United States. And in case of dividends, it's actually of less concern, because if someone forgets about the dividend record date, they're still going to receive the dividend because they're shareholders of record. Now, if someone wants to vote or doesn't want to vote, because voting right is not a cash flow associated right? If you miss the date, you actually miss the opportunity that you really value.
Yeah.
Despite this fact, the disclosure rules that govern dividend distributions and voting rights distributions are dramatically different in the U.S. So in case of dividends, management discloses everything. There is a playing field. Everyone is equally informed. In case of voting rights, all the decision rights about disclosure are basically the hand of management.
Right.
And we have a lot of intermediaries, like you listed, brokerage firms, proxy solicitors, New York Stock Exchange, that have that information and also make money and fees on delivering that information to the customers.
I mean, I spoke to this one proxy solicitor who, I don't know, made it seem like it wasn't such a big deal. He noted that the SEC has a rule that requires all public firms to notify brokers at least 20 business days prior to the record date for an annual meeting. And I think less time, maybe 10 days in advance of the record date for a special meeting. And that proxy solicitor, I guess they have contacts at Broadridge and, you know, calls up the broker or Broadridge to get in information. But I guess you're arguing that even if they don't have to pay a fee, they're able to figure out what the record date is. There's still some asymmetry there. That's not fair for the retail investor for maybe the journalist like myself, who's trying to figure out who owns shares and who's going to be voting certain shares in a heated, close proxy contest and not able to get the record dates. It's not fair, basically. That's what you're suggesting.
Yes. And what we also show in the paper, using, again, tens of thousands of observations, is that all these players that we described, management, New York Stock Exchange, they change their behavior. They don't behave in the same way, suggesting that that information is valuable. Mm-hmm. And they use it to influence the outcome of contested events. Now, we also need to remember that this discussion was primarily focused on existing shareholders who could be institutional investors or retail investors. But in modern financial markets, we know that trading activity is really significant. Shares change hands very often. Mm-hmm. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that any potential investor who maybe would be willing to buy securities and influence the outcome of contested events can be left completely uninformed because they are not still in touch with any broker dealer or anyone like that. And, yeah. And again, proxy solicitors will not know that they need to be informed because they're not shareholders of the company yet. And I think here we can use another case study that we discuss in our paper, which is a Carl Icahn contest with AmTrust, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I covered that situation as well. And I thought it was kind of a bizarre, unusual case. So basically, AmTrust Financial Services, an insurance company, the CEO and a majority shareholder there, decided in 2018 to take his company private. The proposal needed the vote of a majority of the minority shares to go through, and many minority shareholders complained that the price was too low. You know, Carl Icahn took notice, and in April of that year, he began to privately accumulate shares. And by May 17th, this was in 2018, he revealed owning a whopping 9.4% of AmTrust stock, or set. You know, you could calculate that to be 17% of the stock needed to approve the deal. Remember, this was majority of the minority needed to approve the deal. And he said he would solicit proxies against the deal. But there was only this one thing, right? AmTrust had set its record date to April 5th, but didn't disclose it publicly until May 4th. And so what did you discover about Carl Icahn's stock and that whole situation?
Yes, I think we use the case basically to make the point that this asymmetry in what is going on as far as the distribution of voting rights, it's not just about institutional investors versus retail investors. In this example, we see a very, so probably one of the most sophisticated activist investors basically ended up in a situation in which Fund acquired a huge block of shares in the company without voting rights.
Right. How so his entire 9.4% stake was accumulated after the record date. He discovered that after.
Yes. And again, why did it happen? It happened because the fund was not owner of these shares before the record date. All these proxy solicitors and brokerage, they probably even didn't consider contacting him because the fund was not owner of shares yet. Mm-hmm. Now, what was really kind of, it shows you how strategic the players are. As you said, the record date in that proxy, in that event was April 5th. Mm-hmm. And it was determined, obviously, before April 5th. We show in our paper that on April 9th, the company filed a preliminary proxy statement that left the information about the record date missing, even though the record date was already determined by that date. So again, it was that space for the record date left blank,
right,
meaning that it was a strategic decision to not disclose that information, and they kept it private. Mm-hmm. They kept it not publicly visible, available all the way through May 4th. Mm-hmm. And again, what is really astonishing about all this situation, there is no violation of any legal rule here. Mm-hmm. What we are arguing in our paper, that this distribution of voting rights basically is partially regulated by federal law, partially regulated by state's law, but there is no comprehensive regulation and rulemaking on when that information needs to be disclosed to public at large.
So you argue that, because initially I was always looking at this, I said, well, why doesn't the Securities and Exchange Commission just write a rule that you have to publicly disclose the record date prior to the record date? And so, but what you're suggesting is, a lot of this stuff, yeah, I guess they have to disclose it when they filed a definitive proxy statement, but they don't have to disclose the record date when they filed a preliminary proxy statement, even though maybe the record date had already been set prior to the filing of the preliminary proxy. So basically, this is kind of some sort of battle between state regulators like Delaware and the SEC over who has the authority to regulate when record dates are disclosed. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, I don't think there is currently a battle, but what is happening is that there is basically a vacuum space in which basically if companies are in compliance with federal and state regulation, they still have a lot of flexibility in terms of deciding when proxy statements are going to include the record date. And again, it shows you in Amtrust example that it's not like irrelevant situation. Companies do strategically change their behavior when they believe that they can influence voting outcomes. Sometimes they leave that information private. Sometimes they disclose it in advance. And what we conjecture in the paper, one of the drivers of that is the desire of companies to influence what retail investors are going to be doing.
Yeah, it was interesting. The Exxon, remember we looked at that, and Exxon, which are arguably the biggest, most interesting proxy fight of 2021, which was this engine number one kind of environmentally themed director contest at Exxon. They disclosed the date of the record date in advance of the actual record date. Maybe that was because they wanted to make sure that retail investors voted because there was a huge retail base at Exxon. I'm just guessing hypothetically here. And the retail investors tend to vote with management. So they wanted to make sure that every retail investor that could vote would vote, because that's one tiny vote in favor of the incumbents. It didn't work out for Exxon very well. You know, three dissident directors got elected to the board, but that was a case where the record date was put in charge. But you also brought up this interesting point, Professor Foss, about sometimes the companies will postpone the meetings. You know, maybe they don't feel that they have enough shareholder support for their incumbent slate or for a merger or something like that. But they don't have to change the record date, right? So the record date stays the same, but the meeting is delayed. Is that fair? I mean, are we talking about Delaware incorporated companies? Tell me about that scenario.
Well, I don't know all details now, but I see in many cases these things happening. We in our sample, there are many companies that change the meeting date but keep the record date unchanged. And again, given large, as I said, early trading, the kind of very extensive trading activity. If you think about delaying meeting date and keeping record date the same, it means that people who will be owning your shares by the time of the meeting date are less likely to have voting rights. Right? But people who actually have the voting rights, because the record date was several months before the meeting, they probably already don't care about the outcome of the vote. So they probably are less likely to vote. And you think about 2, 3, 4 months period, for a typical company, for a typical public company, we know that more than 20, 30% of shares can change hands.
Right.
And basically, we can have a situation in which a large fraction of investors who have the right to vote because they own the shares on the record date actually is already disinterested in voting and taking actions that, in their view, lead to higher firm value.
Yeah. I mean, a related subject is this issue that I often talk about on the podcast, which is large institutional investors are lending out shares for a fee. And then when there's a proxy fight, both sides try to get the institutional investor, the index fund, let's say Vanguard, State Street, BlackRock, whatever, they're going to support their side to recall their shares prior to the record date so they can vote them in favor of the incumbent or dissident slate, whoever they're working for. And so, yeah, so they want to know what the record date is, and that's why they will pay the fees and it's worth their while to get that information. But you're right, outside of all this, the retail investor, they don't know what the record date is. The Carl Icahn example is interesting with Amtrust. And now that we're looking at it, you know, how did he not have the resources to go and get a proxy solicitor? I don't know if he had a proxy solicitor to try to figure out what the record date was so that he could know that he was buying the shares in advance. But even he, in this case, bought this huge stake and it was after the record date. So they didn't get to vote them. But in that case, the family that was taking the company private did hike the price slightly to kind of close the deal. I guess a lot of the other investors that did own shares prior to the record date were sufficiently disgruntled, and the majority of the minority weren't going to support that deal. But you know, maybe it would have turned out differently if Carl Icahn's 9.4% stake, 17%, well, as you said, of the total amount there, would have had a voting power. But anyways, it's definitely a very interesting thing. So yeah, bottom line, you don't think, Professor Foss, that the SEC could just write a rule tomorrow saying that you have to disclose the record date in advance of the record date?
I think to me, that rule would be very straightforward. It would be, it actually would, I believe that would make the distribution of the voting right very much aligned with, for example, distribution of dividends. The cost of implementing, the direct cost of implementing that is trivial because, you know, these days it doesn't cost much to put a preliminary proxy statement with record date online. Of course, the implicit cost would, and that I expect is going to invite a lot of resistance, maybe by management of companies, is that it will take the decision to, you know, to choose when to disclose it out of hands of management. And that, I think, is going to be that implicit cost is probably going to create some resistance for that. Now, just to give, and I think it's important when addressing your question, to give an idea about whether it's unusual or not for a country to require the disclosure of voting record date prior to the record date. If you go to EU, that's actually the law. There is a rule that requires all records dates to be disclosed in advance. So the cases that we discuss here would have never happened in that financial market. So again, I think that's definitely a topic to think about and to maybe implement.
Okay, there's one a little kind of related matter that I was wondering. So at the very beginning of our conversation, we talked about how the record dates typically happen 45 to 60 days prior to the meeting. And what is the historical reason behind that? I feel like, you know, a lot of cases, we're writing a lot about how the SEC may soon change the 13D disclosure rules so that right now, when you cross 5% ownership, you don't have to disclose that you've crossed that until 10 days after you've actually crossed that 5% threshold. And this was initially because at the time that the rule was implemented, it made it difficult to disclose. Now with this lightning fast trading and everything, the SEC is seriously considered shortening that. Gary Gensler, the chairman of the SEC, recently said in a speech that he's directed staff to look at this and look into whether you can shorten the amount of days between when you cross a 5% ownership threshold and have to file a 13D. But I'm just wondering, with the record date, why has it historically been set so many days in ahead of the meeting? Why is this there's such a big separation? And is that something you could shorten? I don't know who that would benefit.
That's a very good question. And Ron, I have several research papers that actually use data on Schedule 13D trading, and we actually show how often investors take more time after they cross 5% threshold to trade securities. There, it's basically the question is whether you want to help activist investors or you want to limit their ability to buy more shares at the pre-disclosed price. In this case, when we think about the record date and the median date, I want to again re-emphasize, probably there is a historical reasons based on technology and the actual mailing of proxy statements and proxy cards back to companies and proxy solicitors. And obviously now these things could be happening much faster. And I think economic motivation for maybe putting record date closer to the meeting date is, and again, if trading activity is intensive, if many shareholders trade, we want to make sure that people who have voting rights, who basically own shares on the record date, are also people who will be casting their votes at the meeting date. And now, because the time between the record date and meeting date is so long, and sometimes, you know, when meeting days are delayed, it becomes even more than several months.
Wow.
We basically have a situation in which large groups of investors who have the voting right, they are disinterested in taking the right action and vote their shares.
Yeah, it seems like this is a situation where the companies like to have the control of this, but the technology could seriously shorten the record date. And we have this bizarre situation involving where we have all these empty, the possibility of empty votes. I don't know if these institutional investors that have the right to vote but no longer own the shares are actually voting. I feel like I read somewhere that they have policies that they won't vote shares that they don't own anymore, a lot of these institutional investors. But you have this separation of votes and ownership that is a whole part of this, that's part of the bizarre bureaucratic Kafkaesque world that Professor Foss, you've helped uncover. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. We've been speaking to Professor Foss at Boston College. Department of Finance, and he's co-authored The Distribution of Voting Rights to Shareholders. Go check it out. And thank you, Professor Foss, for taking the time.
Thank you, Ron. It was my pleasure.